531.
And now for a weekly wrap-up of global politics, joining us now, Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Tāna whālawa, Dr. Stephen, and this morning we begin with President Biden questioning China's explanation of the origin of the coronavirus. What does it matter where it came from?
Good morning, Brian. Yes, so the main thing is to treat the virus, to manage the virus, to get our vaccination and to curb this terrible thing so we can get back to normal. But it does matter geopolitically because the origin of the virus, China claims that the United States started it. The United States claims that China started it. The experts are divided. And it does matter because if China is lying, if in fact the virus began in a Chinese laboratory and escaped, it will discredit China's narrative as being a leader in the curbing of the virus and the donor of the Sinovac vaccine. So it does have geopolitical consequences. At the moment, we simply don't know. We have two different narratives. Oh, three different narratives, and there is an investigation going on in the United States. We'll probably have to wait and see what they come up with, but it's just another example of this global rivalry between the United States and China, and who has the most credible narrative, who would be the most responsible mentor of global politics.
Ceasefires seem to be holding, Dr. Stephen, in Libya, Yemen, and Israel, Palestine. Are we looking at a period of stability emerging in the Middle East?
In our dreams, Brian, it does look good. The shooting has stopped in most places, and it looks like a kind of a lull has taken place. The underlying problems, the tensions, the countervailing claims, the conflicting interests are still there. But at least we're not killing people, and that has got to be a good thing in the interim. But the conflict has actually shifted to a slightly different mode. There's no doubt that Hamas will be replenishing its rocket supplies with the help of Iran. There's no doubt that Israel will be supplying its Iron Dome anti-missile program with the help of the United States, and this process will be going on. Now, ironically, ceasefires can actually help the aggressor. Now, I'm thinking of Afghanistan, where the ceasefire there has actually led to great advances by the Taliban. The Taliban now, they're not attacking the government outposts. They're simply surrounding the government outposts. They're then bribing or inducing or paying off or threatening the local elders to go to the outpost and ask the soldiers there, surrender your weapons, and we won't kill you. We will let you go back to your families. And this is working pretty well. Something 26 outposts just since the beginning of this month have surrendered. Several hundred soldiers, several hundred weapons have gone into the Taliban side. And so without firing a shot, the Taliban are actually using the ceasefire in a way to increase their territorial control. And this salami tactics is reducing the control of the Kabul government correspondingly. So ironically, ceasefires don't mean stability. They may indeed be a cover for a shifting balance of power between the different contestants.
A surge of African migrants hit Spain last week. Tell us more on that situation, Dr. Stephen.
Oh, this is fascinating, Brian. We know about the migrants from Turkey to Greece. We know about the migrants from Libya to Italy. But this is a new one. It's an old one for the people there, but a new one to us, less familiar with it, because Spain has a couple of little enclaves in Morocco. And the African migrants are trying to go through Morocco and get into these little enclaves, at which time they are in European soil. And they can then be processed and maybe move into the European economy, which is their ultimate goal. Well, the Moroccan government has a claim to the southern territory, the Spanish Sahara area. And Spain supports Spanish Sahara's independence, as does Algeria. So the story gets very complicated because a leader of the opposition group in Spanish Sahara went to Spain to get medical treatment, and the Moroccan government took great exception to this, and to retaliate against Spain, they let the migrants go up to the fence and the beach to these enclaves and clamber over the fence or walk around the beach at low tide, and some 8,000 of them surged into Ceuta, this little Spanish enclave in Morocco, in North Africa itself. Well, that's bad enough. They were expelled. Most of them were expelled, but the children, the unaccompanied minors, humanitarian law says they had to be cared for, and there's some a couple of thousand of them now in Ceuta or in Spain looking for their parents. They can't be sent back because there's nowhere to send them back to, and this is a humanitarian crisis for these young kids. It becomes even more geopolitical because Donald Trump agreed with Morocco that Spanish Sahara was Moroccan, should be Moroccan territory, in return for Morocco recognizing Israel and establishing diplomatic relations. The United States now has scheduled a war game, a military exercise, and some of that exercise is going to take place in Spanish Sahara. Well, as a consequence, Spain has canceled out. Spain said, look, we don't recognize Spanish Sahara as part of Morocco, and we're not going to participate in these war games because it would, in fact, legitimize Morocco's claims. So a small thing like a little enclave and some migrants turns out to have some important geopolitical significance. So this is a part of the world that maybe we should be paying more attention to.
Mm-hmm. Last hour, I spoke with Prime Minister Right Honourable Jacinda Ardern, and one of the things we discussed was the meeting with the Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison, in Queenstown. For you, did the meeting reveal some serious problems?
Well, I think you're well ahead of me on this, Brian, and well done to have gotten an interview with the Prime Minister. My reading of the situation is one of relief that Scott Morrison appeared to be quite reasonable. He agreed with Jacinda Ardern on almost every point and emphasized the close relations between the two countries. So I think we can take some comfort from this meeting. It's reaffirmed what we all knew to be for the last many decades, for the last half century, an exceptionally good relationship between two governments, two countries, two economies, two societies, and that will continue. But there are some irresolvable problems. Number one is the question of sending back New Zealand citizens who grew up in Australia and offended there and are being exported or deported from Australia. And Scott Morrison is unapologetic. He said that's Australian law and he's going to continue to do it. And Ardern will continue to complain, as we all will complain, and that will just have to be managed and perhaps quarantined in pursuit of the better relationship. Another issue is this woman that went to Australia and joined the ISIS, the Islamic State. Australia has taken her citizenship away, and consequently she's going to be returned to New Zealand. They did talk about this. Scott Morrison did indicate that her children possibly could migrate to Australia, and then possibly this woman herself might then return to Australia. So there is some compromise there. On China, the two governments made a joint statement, and they got a joint blast from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China because they did call out China's militarizing of the unauthorized islets in the South China Sea, the harsh treatment of the Uyghurs, and the crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong. So that the two governments are right together on that, despite this inflammatory news document, so-called documentary about New Zealand going soft on China and selling out for economic benefit. At the prime ministerial level, that appears not to be an issue, and the Australian government is comfortable with New Zealand's stance, and the two governments are literally on the same page, and they're getting the same criticism or pushback from China itself. So I think that issue now has departed, and we're going to find that the Trans-Tasman relationship will continue to be as good as it ever has been. And the more often the two prime ministers can meet, because they seem to get along quite well, the better. And it'll be better for all of us as well, with the Trans-Tasman bubble maybe being widened to include more and more of the Pacific Island states. And this is what both prime ministers agree on. And I say it should come sooner rather than later.
Mm. And finally, turning to the Pacific region, Dr. Stephen, and with the legal wrangling continuing in Samoa, the political stalemate continues. Your thoughts and anything in particular you would like to highlight on this current situation as it unfolds?
Yes, well, again, you'll be better informed than I, Brian, but let's assume that Fiame Mataafa becomes the prime minister and the FAST party becomes the governing party. Now, the interesting thing to me as a geopolitician is that she is very skeptical about a big Chinese project, a $100 million project to build a wharf that would accommodate 16 ships. And she says, look, this is excessive. We don't need a 16-ship wharf. We've got already facilities, which is adequate for our small economy. And this would be out of proportion. Already, the debt to China is 40% of Samoa's foreign debt. So the Chinese are making big inroads. And I think she very correctly says, let's balance. Let's not become too dependent on China. Now, at the same time, China is launching a number of projects in Solomon Islands, in Kiribati to extend a runway in Solomon Islands to build a number of sporting facilities for the next Pacific Games. So China is continuing its advance. But if Prime Minister Mataafa says no to China, this could be a very interesting precedent. Already, the Australian government has said no to two of China's big projects in the states of Australia, and other governments are becoming a little bit more, not rejectionary, but they're becoming more selective, and they're asking the Chinese to look, let's look at the fine print, let's look at the long-term indebtedness, let's look at the obligations that we have, and make sure that the benefits spread to the host country, not only to China, but to the host country as well. So I think Prime Minister Mataafa does have an opportunity here to lead the way to a more sensible, more balanced relationship with of the Pacific Island governments with China that can be a benefactor, but is also, in some respects, a worry. And we have to make sure that we get the good things from China and avoid the liabilities. Brian?
Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Always a pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Stephen. Thank you so much for your time and have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.